from KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Hanukkah begins tonight at sundown, and sufganiyot, a.k.a. jelly donuts, are on the menu for today's show. Are you a knish or a pickle? A comedian shares his food-centric Jewish deli zodiac. Chef Ricardo Zarate discusses the Peruvian pantry, and Jonathan Gold talks Irish pub food. But first, let's check in with Laura Avery at the Santa Monica Farmers Market to find out what's fresh and in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're coming up to the holiday season now, and Matt Biancanello is the bartender chef who recently was holding court at the Library Bar at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. Matt is now a free agent, and he's at the market today, as always, getting ingredients. And Matt, you are coming up with holiday-themed drinks, and tell us today what kind of a thing you're creating.
Well, I'm going to be doing a bunch of holiday drinks. I'm going to be teaching a free class next week at the Gourmandise. And one of the drinks that we're going to do is what I'm going to do for you today is an umami milkshake. And I call it that because I'm using two different kinds of mushrooms in the drink. And they're both from Clearwater Farms. I've infused the shiitake mushrooms into the bourbon. And then I also took the chanterelles and cooked them into the cream.
And this is ultimately going to be some kind of a form of amazing eggnog?
Yeah, this is basically an eggnog. So you're basically putting whiskey that's been infused, the cream, agave, and an egg. I also got the eggs from Maggie's Farms that you have to order. And then we're going to double strain in this beautiful, this is a new communion glass for you here.
It's a goblet. Okay, so there is a raw egg in there.
Yes, there is.
Tell us why, you know, raw eggs are not something to be worried about.
Well, these are right from the farm, so I feel really good about the feed that Maggie's Farms is giving them. I actually have been to the farm because that's where my bees were, so I know how they're kept, and I love knowing that I know where they come from. So there's nothing to worry about in terms of that.
Okay.
And then what I do is I like to double strain this. It has that beautiful color. So here you go.
Okay, once this again, at a secret undisclosed location of the farmer's market, I'm drinking eggnog. That is delicious. And this is your version of winter eggnog. And now if we're going to infuse the bourbon and the cream ourselves, tell us that technique.
Yeah, the recipe will definitely be on the website. But what I like to do is I like to take about an ounce of shiitake mushrooms in a bottle of bourbon for 1 week. And then the cream, it's very simple. I take about a half ounce of chanterelles, cut them up. And then with 1 pint of cream, you just cook it on the stove, simmer it for about 20 minutes. And then I turn it off and I cover it for about 2 hours and let it sit. And that's it. It's incredible.
Okay, and tell us more about the class you're doing at the Gourmandise.
The class I'm really excited about. And we're going to do everything from pomegranate seeds infused in Pinot. And then we're going to do champagne cocktails. I've got a beautiful punch that I'm going to do with fresh pomegranate juice. And then we'll do the eggnog as well.
This is so exciting. And to see everything at the market added to your cocktails for the holidays and just to be around you and get your inspiration.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Matt's class, Follow That Chef at the Gourmandise School of Sweets and Savories, will take place next Wednesday, December 12th. The class will meet here at the Farmers Market with Matt. You will shop the market with Matt, and then you'll walk back to the Gourmandise School, which is located on the third floor of Santa Monica Place. The class is free and open to the public, but you must register. So please go to the Gourmandise website and sign up and plan to meet Matt here at the class for the Follow the Chef holiday cocktail class at the market.
And that's at 8:30 a.m.
All right, Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I love it.
This is the time of year when tangerine, a.k.a. satsuma, a.k.a. clementines, come to the market. There's a great deal of confusion. I'm one of those people that grew up in the East that thought the biggest treat at Christmas was to get a tangerine in the toe of my stocking at Christmas. And David Karp is here. He has been doing some recent research about the California clementine. And David, you're here to tell us a little more about what the difference is between a clementine and a tangerine and what the status of these two wonderful fruits are in the growing regions here in California.
I've always thought, as a citrus scientist, that tangerine was a meaningless term. It's just a popular term for a traditional form of mandarin, the kind that you would have gotten in your stocking some years ago. It was thought to be just pure citrus reticulata, pure mandarin, one of the three original species of citrus. Tangerine was just a popular term for those kind like dancy that were relatively reddish orange in color, and It has no botanical significance whatsoever. However, when I was in China recently, they actually distinguish between what they call tangerines. They have different words for them, and mandarins. So tangerines for them refers to actually the archaic forms of mandarin, those that are smaller and more fibrous in texture. Anyway, what is a clementine? You would not have gotten that in your stocking because clementines did not become popular on the East Coast until the 70s when I, for one, fell in love with them. You probably too, if you were still there then. They were imported from Spain. Now, where did they come from originally? Père Clément found them in the late 1890s in an orphanage in Oran, Algeria. And they were brought to Spain within a couple of decades where they formed the basis of a huge export industry starting in the 50s, 60s in Europe and then in the 70s to the United States. At the same time, smaller growers in North San Diego County were planting them, and that's what we mostly get for clementines, although a little bit later in season at farmers markets. So that's the Algerian, which is relatively small, darker in color than some of the other clementines, has a tendency to be seedy. However, that's the definition of flavor when it comes to a clementine.
I guess the outstanding characteristic of the tangerine Satsuma clementine, they're fairly easy to peel, they're thin-skinned, and they section well.
Compared to Satsumas, which are earlier in season, Satsumas have much more tender flesh and they're somewhat lighter in color. Clementines tend to be somewhat more orange. They're a little bit later in season. And Satsumas are just grown on a couple thousand acres across the state. Clementines are now big business in the state. They're what's in the cuties box.
So what kind of clementines are being grown right now in California that we're getting here at the market?
We are getting a few Algerians from Jeff Rieger, from a classic Satsuma growing area, the Sierra foothills in Penryn. We're also going to be getting a few from George Schnurr. I just spoke to him a few minutes ago in Ramona at 2,000 feet, so he's pretty late. They're still slightly green, but he should have them within a week or two. By Christmas, or shortly thereafter, we'll get them from Bob Polito in North San Diego County. And that's just a magic growing area for clementines, and that's what I really wait for myself. But Jeff Rieger's are probably the best that are available right now. They're a lot better than what you'd be getting in a cuties box, and that's for a couple reasons. Number one, Jeff's got the Algerian, which is inherently a better variety. Number two, it's a better growing area, at least marginally up there. And number three, and all important when it comes to any kind of mandarin, is the most delicate and perishable of citrus fruits with their thin skins. And their flavor is relatively evanescent, the aroma and the balance of sweetness and acidity. It's widely acknowledged both by growers and citrus scientists that a mandarin never tastes the same when it's coming out of a packing facility as when it went in. And why is that? It's jostled, it's heated, it's washed. They have to wash it for sanitary reasons. But that strips the wax, and they have to reapply an artificial wax, which then clogs up the respiration, and so the fruits develop off flavors. And with time off the tree, acidity drops, and the balance of sweetness and acidity is critical, along with the aroma, to fruit quality.
So we have now been schooled in the difference between the mandarin, the satsuma, and the clementine. Thank you so much for all that information.
You're very welcome. Sorry if I just spewed forth a torrent of mandarins, but mandarins are very much on my mind at this point. They're the noblest of citrus fruits, the most complex, the most delicious, and aren't we lucky to be able to get them at their best at farmers markets?
Right, and by mandarin, we do mean satsumas and clementines. So, David, as always, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Great talking to you.
That was David Karp, and I have just had a PhD course in mandarins, and it's just been fun to know more, learn more, and now taste even better. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
We've got photos and a recipe for Matthew Biancanello's Umami Milkshake over on the Good Food blog. I've had it, and it is delicious. I'd also like to point out a story on the blog that I think might interest you. Many oyster lovers were really upset by the closing of Drake's Bay Oyster Company up north last week. The company was located on the shores of Point Reyes National Park. Their 40-year lease expired on November 30th this year. A long fight between the oyster company and conservationists ended with Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar's decision to not renew the company's lease. According to Drake's Bay website, that means a loss of 40% of our local oyster supply. But Deep End Diner Eddie Lin writes on the Good Food blog that oyster lovers have another option for seaside oyster shucking much closer to home. Go check out the Jolly Oyster in Ventura County. It's been mentioned on the show before, but if you go to kcrw.com/goodfood, you can find Eddie's write-up along with some photos. Here with me now is Gustavo Arellano, editor of the OC Weekly and the voice of Orange County restaurants here on Good Food. He joins us today to solve our taco cravings. Hi, Gustavo.
Hola, Evan.
Where are we going?
We are going to go on Twitter right now. Go to twitter.com/Taco Maria, and we're going to figure out where on earth this truck is right now as we speak.
Taco Maria. So is it an old-style lonchero?
No, it's a Lux Lonchera, and I've always been very skeptical of these gourmet food trucks, which I, of course, call Lux Loncheras, but Taco Maria is a real deal, and it's really a great story on top of that. So the owner behind Taco Maria is a guy by the name of Carlos Salgado. His family's had a restaurant in the city of Orange for, oh, geez, as far as I can remember, La Siesta, and it's a good restaurant, you know, Mexican immigrants running it, but, of course, Americanized, so kind of a Calmex type of restaurant. Salgado, he decides to go into culinary school, moves up to the Bay Area, works at different Michelin-starred restaurants as a pastry chef, then decides to come back home a couple years ago and says, you know, I want to help out the family. I think, you know, the restaurant's falling on hard times. So he does that. This is the time, though, when all these Lux Loncheras are starting to become popular. So Salgado says, I'm going to start doing my own Lux Lonchera. I'm going to take that background of mine, you know, as a child of Mexican immigrants, but I'm also going to infuse it with the traditions that I learned working at these higher-end restaurants, and voila, you have Taco Maria.
So give us an idea of what you like to eat when you find Taco Maria.
So you want to start off with the tacos. The tacos, what he does, for instance, he has one taco with arrachera, which is really a fancy way of saying carne asada, but we're not going to hold it against Carlos. He'll get an arrachera, mixes it up with shishito peppers, mixes it up with, you know, some cheese, and then makes it on a tortilla. So it's a regular taco. What you want to do, you want to ask him to make it crispy. So what's going to happen, you're not going to have a taco shell all of a sudden, a taco shell from Old El Paso. He'll actually give it the tiniest bit of frying. So just actually the edges of the tortilla or the top of the tortilla, the ends of the tortilla, they crisp up and all of a sudden you have the spice of the shishito pepper, that wonderful arrachera, and then the crispiness. It just ties everything in together. And also, he doesn't have it right now on the menu, so you have to beg him to please do it. He used to have this vegetarian taco called the jardineros taco, a gardener taco, and he actually used pumpkin in this taco, calabaza.
That sounds really delicious.
And better than that, though, he made a salsa made from semillas, from pumpkin seeds. So he, instead of snout to tail, he did stem to bottom with this pumpkin. Oh my God, it was so, so good. So in the meanwhile, though, what you want to get is what made him famous initially, a quesadilla de tuétano, so a quesadilla of bone marrow.
Now, you know, it seems like every lonchera, Lux Lonchera in particular, has a signature item. Would that be his?
Yeah, that's the one that made him the most famous. You know, it's not my favorite one. That said, it's spectacular. So you have this bit, like your regular quesadilla that we know here in Southern California, the flour tortilla. But what he does, he uses queso Oaxaca. So you get the quesillo, nice and long, melts really well, retains its milkiness and gets stretchy. But on top of that, then he puts in bone marrow. And bone marrow, of course, is impossibly rich. This is something that if you're, say on the west side or even a higher end Alta Cocina restaurant, you're going to be paying $15, $20 for it. Here you can get it for about $7, if that.
So if you order that quesadilla filled with quesillo and bone marrow, you're going to need something to clean your palate afterwards. Do they have anything special to drink?
It's a Mexican lonchera. So, of course, you're going to have agua frescas. Of course, that being the drinks made with fruit or sometimes horchata rice water. Carlos, he's really attuned to farmer's markets, so he gets as much of his produce as possible from the SoCo farmer's market down in Costa Mesa. And so he goes with what the seasons is. My favorite drink that he makes an horchata with cilantro seeds. which it gives it this toastiness. The only time I had ever had that type of horchata was at a Salvadoran restaurant. They get the toastiness by toasting rice. Here, though, right now what he has a Jamaica fresa drink. So it's hibiscus with strawberry. Nice and tart. I'm not a big fan of Jamaica, but it's almost like a Mexican Arnold Palmer. Let's call it Arnoldo Palmer, if you want. The fresa, the strawberry, just cuts the tartness of the Jamaica, and it's incredibly refreshing.
Thank you so much.
Gracias, Evan.
That was Gustavo Arellano, editor of the OC Weekly. You can find the Taco Maria truck location by following their Twitter handle, at Taco Maria. Last I checked, the bone marrow quesadilla had rotated off the menu, but Carlos says it will likely make an appearance as the weather cools down. Next up, we'll discuss jelly donuts and the Jewish deli zodiac. That's in 30 seconds right here on KCRW and KCRW.com.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at KCRW.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Tonight is the first night of Hanukkah. And if you're celebrating the holiday, or if you have friends who do, you probably are going to eat fried foods. Jews eat fried foods on Hanukkah to commemorate the miracle of a tiny bit of oil that lasted for 8 days when the Jews returned to the Holy Temple after their war with the Greeks. Traditional foods usually include potato pancakes called latkes and a fried jelly donut called a sufganiya, or sufganiyot, which is the plural. Here to talk with me about how to make your own sufganiyot is Dan Messinger, owner of Bibi's Bakery and Cafe in the Pico Robertson neighborhood here in L.A. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm just so thrilled because you brought this. Just, you are going to make so many KCRW workers so happy.
I will probably make 10 happy because someone's going to get 3 of them of the dozen.
No, I think some people will actually attempt to share them. Now, we're referring to these plump, gorgeous, beautiful jelly donuts. And you know what's really interesting is I kind of feel like sufganiyot are a Jewish secret. Like, it seems like everybody in mass culture now knows what latkes are. You read about latkes all over the place as we approach Hanukkah, but less so the jelly donuts. Is it an Israeli tradition, something that developed in Israel?
I don't think that it's Israeli in origin, but I do think that the trend has taken off in Israel. There's definitely a lot of innovation or upping the ante in Israel. I've seen some pretty special sufganiyot. They're traditionally jelly-filled, but not always. I brought a few custard and chocolate-filled. I've seen pictures in Israel of like a black forest sufganiya and all different types of filling. One or two that actually have little plastic, not syringes, little plastic tubes that have a shot of chocolate liqueur or different types of alcohol that you can inject right before you eat the sufganiya.
So people are pouring alcohol into their jelly donuts before they consume them.
It wasn't indulgent enough to have a donut, so how could we possibly make this more indulgent?
So, like, are they mixing Manischewitz with strawberry jelly?
I hope not. I hope not. But I've seen worse.
Now, everybody tends to focus on the filling, but I am of the opinion that to have a good jelly donut or a good custard-filled donut, if your mother dough, if the yeast dough is not good, then it doesn't matter what it's filled with.
I think that's right. I mean, I think like most good foods, if not things in life, it's about the right balance. So if you're just jelly, then all you remember is that goopiness. Or likewise, if you don't have enough filling and it's just, you know, doughy, you're like, well, I'm just eating a piece of bread. I'm having a bagel and jelly right now.
And there should be a contrast between the dough and the filling. The dough shouldn't be so sweet that then when you hit the filling, you need to take a pill.
Yes. I mean, I don't think this is a diabetic-friendly holiday, or religion for that matter, but I do think you're right. I do think you want to have a dough that is sweet enough so that it works well with something sweeter, but it doesn't overpower and get you into a sugar coma.
So are there any tips you can give us for working with the dough or making the dough that will give us a great result? I've never had a good result making a filled donut at home. The dough just doesn't come out right for me.
I think that part of it is letting it rise the right amount of time. You want to make sure that you're not over-rising and you're also not under-rising. I think a lot of people get impatient when they're making donuts and they don't let the dough proof properly. So you want to make sure that it's risen, depending on the recipe, perhaps twice to what your original batter is. And then I think you need to make sure your oil is hot enough. A lot of people will throw them in the oil too much and they'll soak it up like a sponge instead of getting that nice crispiness. And then you're eating a ball of oil, which may be traditional, but is not very good.
And what is the temperature you're frying at?
We're frying at about between 325 and 350. And you also have to remember when you're doing more than one batch, that when you do fry the initial batch, that it does lower the temperature a bit. You have to let the oil come back to temperature.
And you don't want to crowd the pan too much. You want them to be able to bob around.
Correct.
So you filled these with, there are three kinds I see. There's a custard and chocolate and then a jam. Your jelly donuts, your soufganiyot, are what is called parve.
Yes. So our all of our baked goods at the bakery and our donuts included are parve, which means they're non-dairy. So we don't use any dairy products or milk or butter or anything in making them. And that way they can be eaten traditionally for people who keep kosher with a meat meal or after a meat meal.
Or a dairy meal.
Or a dairy meal, certainly.
I've heard that dulce de leche is a popular filling in Israel, but you wouldn't be able to do that.
It would be hard for me because then it would be, by definition, dairy. And dulce de mocha mix is not as exciting as dulce de leche.
That's very, very true. Thank you so much, Dan. That was fantastic. And I can't wait to share these beautiful soufganiyot with everybody.
It is my pleasure. I want to wish you a happy Hanukkah, and we will see you around the Pico Robertson neighborhood.
That was Dan Messinger. He comes to us from Bibi's Bakery and Cafe in the Pico Robertson area here in Los Angeles. We've been talking about the jelly donut tradition at Hanukkah. What would you do if someone advised you to marry pastrami later in life? It's sage wisdom if you happen to be a pickle and you're consulting the Jewish Deli Zodiac. Developed by Seth Front, the Zodiac entertains while also educating its followers on the history of the migration of Eastern Europeans and their food to deli counters that are adorned with such delicacies as knish, egg creams, and chopped liver. How did this whole thing start? Were you inspired by the Chinese Zodiac?
Well, it started at a place where good things always happen to Jews, a Chinese restaurant. I was at a Chinese restaurant looking at the Chinese Zodiac placemat, and I looked up, and everyone in the restaurant was Jewish. It was not Christmas Day. And all of a sudden, the clouds parted, the angels sang, and God spoke to me, and he said, "Jewish Zodiac." And I said to myself, well, what would a Jewish zodiac be? It wouldn't be year of the dragon and year of the ox. It would have to be year of the bagel and year of the lox. So I'm a comedy writer. I'm a son of a rabbi. And as every good Jew is, I'm a foodie. And so I said, well, how do you personify, for instance, a bagel? I know how to personify a rat because they have human characteristics, but how about a bagel? So put my comedy hat on. I said, well, if you're a bagel, you're pliable and you always bounce back, although you feel something's missing in your center. If this persists, get some therapy, compatible with schmear and lox.
That's very, very good. So how did you assign years to each of these new emblems?
Well, I took the 12 most iconic deli foods. I wrote up the expressions for each of them. And then the years, I tell people God spoke to me, but really it was fairly random. And I'm surprised how seriously Jews take these years. God forbid you hate chopped liver and you're born in the year of the chopped liver. I hear it to no end.
And what are you?
I am a bagel.
You're a bagel?
But I got to choose, so I'm a bagel.
That's true. Take us through a few of them.
Well, pickle is one of my favorites. You're the perfect sidekick. Friends love your salty wit and snappy banter, but you never overshadow them. That shows genuine seasoning from when you were a cucumber. Marry a pastrami later in life.
That's so awesome. Okay, well, apparently I'm a knish, so what about me?
Flaky on the surface, you're actually a person of depth and substance. Consider medical or law school, but don't get too wrapped up in yourself.
Very, very funny. So let's talk a little bit about these foods. These foods come from the Eastern European tradition of Jewish cookery. When did America see the largest immigration of Jews from Eastern Europe?
Well, that started in 1880 with the assassination of the Russian Tsar, which was, of course, blamed on the Jews, you know, men like Tevye who are way off in the shtetl. But we got blamed, so we came to America, about 2.5 million in that period starting from 1880, and we ended up on the Lower East Side and in the boroughs. And we brought with us our foods, some which were brought directly from Eastern Europe, like the knish and like the pickle.
And what about things like lox? What are some others? Is kasha one?
Kasha is not one of the 12 most iconic Jewish deli foods, so it's not included in the Jewish zodiac. But let's talk about the knish, for instance. Now, knishes are iconic to the city of New York. The story of pushcarts and the knish can be, we can talk about a man like Yonah Schimmel, who has his famous Yonah Schimmel shop on Houston Street. His story is basically the story of many immigrants who went into the food business. He had a pushcart and he had a great recipe. And he became very, very famous. And then in 1910, he opened up his shop. He opened up his shop because in 1906, the city of New York got tired of all the pushcarts. So they started regulating them. They only gave out a certain number of licenses. And they also said, if you have a pushcart, you have to keep it in one place. Well, what's the point of a pushcart if you can't push it? And so many of these vendors like Yonah Schimmel and Joel Russ of Russ and Daughters with the Lox, they open up shops later, Yonah Schimmel in 1910.
Is Yonah Schimmel still open?
It is still there on Houston Street. And when you go down the Lower East Side, you make the pilgrimage. You go to Yonah Schimmel's, and then you walk a block, and you go to Russ and Daughters for some lox, and then hopefully you go to the Tenement Museum to learn all about it and digest your food, and then you come back to Katz's, and you have lunch, and then you take 3 Lipitor.
Isn't that the truth? So let's talk about the latke.
The latke isn't really that interesting of a story. The latke basically talks about our dependence on potatoes when we were in Eastern Europe. We knew how to make potatoes 15 different ways, and the latke was one of them. I think what's more interesting is the pastrami, because we really have 4 stages here in America. The first one is, first stage is arrival. What foods do we arrive with, like the knish and the pickle? The second stage is adaptation. How do we adapt? Pastrami is a great example of that, because in Eastern Europe, we did not kill a cow in order to have a pastrami sandwich. Tevye wouldn't kill his cow, which provided his livelihood because he was a dairyman. So we actually made pastrami out of geese in Eastern Europe. Here in America, we had the cow, and that's what we made it out of. What's interesting is in this adaptation phase, we go from the first generation of Jews who open up the delis, and the second generation, their sons and daughters, mainly their sons, who were born in America. And we have clients coming in who aren't Jewish who want a slice of cheese on top of that sandwich. And he says, well, why should I have a kosher deli? Why should I pay this Orthodox rabbi to stand over my shoulder? And that's how we get the rise of the New York deli, the kosher style deli. And so pastrami is very interesting because of that. Also lox. There's the Christian Holy Trinity, right? The Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. The Jewish Holy Trinity, bagels, lox, and cream cheese. One bite and you will find God.
What about cream cheese?
Cream cheese is a fantastic story. You would think we had cream cheese way back in Eastern Europe, but we didn't. Think of borscht. Think of borscht with that dollop of almost creme fraiche. That's what we had as cream cheese back then. Cream cheese is an American invention. It was created in 1872 by a New York dairyman named William Lawrence. He's trying to make Neufchâtel cheese, and it comes out wrong. It comes out as this spreadable, creamy cheese. And everyone seems to like it. He puts it on bread. He seems to like it. So he decides to market it. And since he's so proud of the city of New York and New York State, because he's from New York, he, of course, calls his cream cheese Philadelphia brand cream cheese.
I mean, it's hilarious.
And it's called Philadelphia brand cream cheese because he wanted to associate this bastardized version of Neufchâtel cheese with quality. And the culinary capital of the United States in 1872 was Philadelphia. That's where the best chefs and the best restaurants were because of the political power of the Continental Congress. I want to talk about chopped liver a little
bit. Okay, please talk about chopped liver.
You know, chopped liver is a testament to our Eastern European ancestors and how clever they were, because they would have, meat or chicken maybe once a week on the Friday night meal, and they'd make a whole other appetizer out of parts that we generally throw away today, the liver. They, with the chicken fat, the schmaltz, and the onions, and the hard-boiled egg, and they'd make an appetizer fit for a king. Now, historians rarely agree on anything, but they've come to a consensus that the best chopped liver ever made was my mother's.
I love that. Thank you so much, Seth.
My pleasure.
That was Seth Front, creator of the Jewish Deli Zodiac. Find out what sign you are on the Good Food blog. Coming up, Cambodian cooking in Long Beach, and Chef Ricardo Zarate gives us a taste of Peru. Stay tuned.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. If I were to ask you to name one Cambodian dish, could you do it? Unlike neighboring Thailand and Vietnam, Cambodian food isn't that well known in the U.S. After attending the Cambodian New Year's Festival in Long Beach earlier this year, independent producer Sonata Lee Narcisse discovered the flavors and community behind Cambodian cuisine in the L.A. area. She joins us with this report.
Chad Fung, the owner of Lily Pad Catering, is preparing his food booth for what promises to be a busy day of serving Cambodian food to festival goers at this year's Cambodian New Year celebration.
It's a very close-knit community, and we have gathering like this. It's a blessing just to see relatives, aunts, and uncles come together, and food is the main topic of festivals like this.
When you think of Cambodian food, what comes to mind? Tough question, right? Cambodia is nestled in between Thailand and Vietnam, but Cambodian cuisine isn't as popular as Thai and Vietnamese. Both cuisines have had a strong influence on Cambodian fare, but Chad Fung says there are some major differences.
Cambodian cuisine is very different, very earthy, really down to earth, all the organic ingredients, and that's what makes our food so unique and different from the surrounding area in Southeast Asia.
When Chad describes Cambodian cuisine as earthy, he's referring to its heavy reliance on what he calls root ingredients that flavor dishes. Galangal root, with its pale yellow skin, is deceptively similar in appearance to ginger, but it has a more peppery flavor profile. Turmeric also comes from a plant root, and you'll find it in many traditional dishes. This deep yellowish powder is best known as the main ingredient in curries. Now, you'll also taste the rind and leaves of the kaffir lime, as well as the subtle citrus flavor of lemongrass in Cambodian cuisine. All of these ingredients are in one of Chad's favorite traditional dishes.
In the Cambodian, it's called nom pachok. It's a really earthy soup base with chicken or fish, and then it has a lot of lemongrass, and you can add coconut, and then you have a plate of like organic vegetables such as cucumber, cabbage, banana roots, and papaya, green bean, all that organic stuff. And then you put it in your noodles, and then you squeeze a little bit of lime and add a little bit of chili, and it's really great.
As I make my way around the food court, I meet Maurice Yin at the Sloppy Moe's barbecue booth. He schools me on what's probably the most distinctive Cambodian ingredient.
There are specific ingredients that Cambodians use that other cultures don't use. One is what we call prahok, and it's basically a fermented fish, and that's ground up into a paste. And we use that as just like a very strong seasoning.
Strong might be an understatement. The gray, pasty ingredient has a pungent smell, reminiscent of Limburger cheese. But Cambodian chefs swear by it. They say that prahok adds a certain body to dishes that can't be duplicated. Around midday, the food court is jumping with live music and families gathered around park benches. A long line has formed at another booth called Sofif. In the back, cooks flip dozens of rows of beef skewers on the grill. That's where I met a young lady named Erica, who just picked up her order.
This is called Seko Ang, which is like beef stick barbecued. And it's got like a pickled veggie that goes with it. It's a must. You have to eat it together.
She says that her family usually makes beef sticks themselves. But this year, they didn't feel like putting the work in. Making beef sticks is pretty labor-intensive. The beef chunks are marinated in a mixture of lemongrass, turmeric, galangal root, and oyster sauce for 2 hours minimum. And that doesn't include the time it takes to chop all those fresh ingredients. During the festival, I was told that if you really want to experience Cambodian cuisine, you have to visit Long Beach's Cambodia Town. This mile-long stretch along Anaheim Boulevard is the heart of the Cambodian-American community in Southern California. Driving down the business corridor, you'll see plenty of Cambodian-owned clothing stores, jewelry shops, churches, and temples. That's where Sophie's restaurant is located. I visited Sophie at her restaurant so I could get a lesson in Cambodian food 101. In the kitchen, one of her chefs pulls out a giant skillet and begins preparing a popular chicken dish.
Well, now he's putting a little oils in there to stir fry. And now he's putting a paste, a lemongrass paste.
While the chicken is still cooking, the chef adds prahuk to the skillet. Although on its own, prahuk has that strong, pungent smell, when the chef pairs it with chicken or another protein, the aroma is downright mouth-watering, and the final taste is delicious.
So at last, they're going to put a wild basil to give a little bit more aroma of the flavor. Yeah. So
next up, the chef prepares a traditional dish named after Cambodia's capital city.
This is a pumpen noodle that we're making right now. There's a slice of pork, and there's a pork meatball. There's a noodle, there's a ground pork in it. There's always a side of bean sprout that go with it, or lime juice.
These noodles are served as a breakfast dish in Cambodian homes. The flavorful broth has a hint of sweetness, and exploring a bowl of Phnom Penh noodles is like going on a scavenger hunt. You don't know what you'll find. You might discover a thin slice of fish, you could bite into a pork meatball, or even grab a bunch of fresh bean sprouts. But whatever you do, eat your noodles right away, Sophie warns.
If you leave it long, the noodle will just be soggy.
Sophie Kut has owned her restaurant in Cambodia Town for more than 10 years. Last year, she opened another restaurant in her native Cambodia. She and the other Cambodian chefs at this year's Cambodian New Year celebration believe that with time and more exposure, their cuisine will catch up in popularity to other Southeast Asian cuisines.
Their country has been grow very rapidly, and they're able to create, invent a lot of new stuff. And for us, we just slowly, but I'm sure one of these days we'll be up there also.
For KCRW's Good Food, I'm Sonata Lee Narcisse.
All of the segments you hear from independent producers here on Good Food are made possible by KCRW's Independent Producer Project. Check it out at kcrw.com/IPP. The flavors and ingredients of Peru have landed in LA in a major way, thanks to Chef Ricardo Zarate. The Peruvian-born chef first caught our attention with Mochica in 2009. It began as a humble market stall in downtown's Mercado La Paloma. But recently, it's moved to a more glamorous locale on 7th Street downtown. Ricardo's also the chef behind the popular small plates restaurant Pica and was crowned Food & Wine's Best New Chef of 2011. Ricardo joins us today on Good Food to talk about the flavors of his homeland. I'm so happy to have you here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm so curious to ask you, when you think of the food of your childhood and you're cooking now, what are flavors that you remember and that are trying to recreate?
You know, I don't know if you've seen the movie Ratatouille.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really love that movie. And I really, really love the movie because the message in the end, you know, food is memory, you know, and this is what it's all about, you know. And food is the memories of your grandma cooking, your mom, you know. So, yeah, every time I cook, I try to memorize that flavors I have and trying to bring in here alive again, you know. And that's what I do all the time.
Is there such a thing as a Peruvian flavor profile?
I do believe, yes. I think it's very unique. It's very hard to explain, but it's very unique. We use a lot of grains, you know, in Peruvian cuisine. And, you know, a lot of also acidity, you know, especially where I come from, the coast.
So you brought with you these six little containers filled with interesting things. So let's talk first about the corn, because I can see two that immediately I can identify as some kind of corn, and then a third that I guessed was corn.
Yeah.
What are they? And describe what they look like.
In Peru, we have so many type of corn. So I just, you know, this morning I pick up the three I have in, you know, in, like closer to me. But we have a lot of type of corn. But these ones in front, you have, you know, the choclo. It's a corn like the regular corn, we call it in Peru, fresh one. Then we got the cancha, which is a dry corn. It's like a popcorn, but it doesn't pop like the pop. But it pops, but you need to toast it, you know. And then the other one called jora.
Jora.
Maíz de jora, which is another type of corn. Which is used to ferment it and to make alcohol.
Yeah, it smelled very winey, and it's darker brown with kind of purple overtones, and it looks like there's some silk from the corn in it, like all the little hairs that you have to pull off the ear.
Yeah, how we make it, like this jora, you know, we put it into a pot. Normally, we add the water. We add chancaca, which is the piloncillo or the sugar cane, I think, you know, to give the sweetness, just to help the fermentation. We boil it one time and then leave it in room temperature for about, let's say, 24 hours or 48 hours until the fermentation starts. Then you keep in the refrigeration for a week. And then it becomes like a beer, you know, like a...
Like pulque.
Yeah. And, you know, it's very traditional. And a lot of the dishes we cook in Peru, we use in the chicha de jora, we call it.
Wow. So do you use it as in savory cooking, just to add a little flavor?
Yeah. We use it like, you know, when you cook with wines in French cuisine, we use it to cook with chicha de jora. But I will not recommend to get drunk with this one because I try it and you will have a very, very bad hangover.
Okay, so now you talked about grains earlier and you have two grains here. One looks like quinoa.
Yeah, one is quinoa and the other one is kiwicha.
Kiwicha.
Kiwicha. Kiwicha is I believe, you know, is the same family as the quinoa. It's a different type of grain. And it's available in stores. And the kiwicha is 100% sure is more, it has more nutrients in there. It's more healthy than the quinoa. It's easy to cook, the same as the quinoa. You can boil it in stocks, you can boil it in water. But the only problem with the kiwicha, they sticks together. It's a smaller grain and it sticks together.
But sometimes sticking together is nice.
Yeah, I like it. So, you know, I think it's going to get very popular soon, you know, because I saw it start coming strong. And then in my country, we do kiwicha cereals too. You know, we cook it, we dry it, it's pop-ups, and we use it for cereal for kids. And actually in Mochica, I'm doing a dish with kiwicha, and doing a creme brulee with kiwicha, and underneath I'm doing like a purple corn custard with fruits. I mean, it's really amazing.
So that purple corn, what do you call it? Morada?
Yeah, maíz morado, which is a purple corn, maíz morado. And from that, we do the famous soft drink in Peru called chicha morada.
It's delicious. I mean, one of my favorite foods ever of all time, it might be my favorite food, is masa. So for me, just corn, the sort of Mexican South way of treating corn is fascinating and so delicious. One of the things that's so interesting about what you're doing at Mochica is you're bringing meats too, meats and fish that are a little unusual. you have an alpaca burger on the menu.
Yes. Alpaca is, you know, it's been consuming my country for since the Incas, you know, before the Incas. So it's a very lean meat. It's very fantastic, actually. I love it. It depends what part of the alpaca you use.
And the alpaca that you're using, is it American alpaca or do you have to import it?
This alpaca is American alpaca. I believe, you know, the future of the world is we need to, you know, let's not do one product, let's start opening more, you know, like this is the sustainability match. I mean, my goal when I cook Peruvian food and introducing the ingredients is I want to see other chefs using it, you know, and people from their homes and house, you know. I'm very impressed how the quinoa was welcoming here in America. I mean, it's something new. I mean, a few years ago, I would say 10 or 15 years, it started coming, but now it's super popular.
Thank you so much, Ricardo.
No, thank you very much for inviting me.
Ricardo Zarate continues to educate Angelenos about Peruvian food at his restaurants Mochica and Pica. And we're all eagerly awaiting his third restaurant, Paiche, due to open early next year in Marina del Rey. Find his recipe for sea bass tiradito on the Good Food blog. We're going to take a quick 30-second break, and then we'll have Jonathan Gold in the studio, plus a chef talks about foraging for staples of the Greek pantry.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Good Food. We'll continue our globe-trotting show with my next guest, Eric Kosselman. He helms San Francisco's restaurant, Kokari. Eric was trained with classic French techniques, but a Greek cuisina isn't a French cuisine. I asked him if he has any yayas standing over his shoulder in the kitchen at Kokari.
They're all welcome. We have several Greeks that work at the restaurant. And if I have questions about a dish, they always ask their mothers or their grandmothers if they're still around. We also have guests that are of Greek heritage and remember their grandmother's food. They always give me feedback. And it's great to hear that something that I've made reminds them of their grandmother's food.
Yeah, that must just feel fantastic.
Of course, it's never quite as good as grandma's, but
of course
we try.
Did you spend a certain amount of time in Greece to sort of just inhale the perfume, as it were, of the kitchen?
Yeah, I mean, Greek food is a lot to do with lifestyle as well. I mean, as do most of the cuisines. It's not just about ingredients and preparation, but it has to do with the whole way of living and gathering food.
Is that gathering still done as it was back in the day?
Oh, yes. It's funny. One of the partners that owns the restaurant always tells a story of her mother used to go and collect greens next to the schoolyard where the kids went to school. And they would always ask their mother to ask Yaya not to come around the school to pick greens while they were at school because they didn't want their friends to see her. So it's very traditional to go out and forage for things. Horta, for instance, is still collected. It's not something that you cultivate and grow in your garden. You go and pick it in the wild.
Is horta one particular kind of green, or is it a collection of greens?
Typically, horta in a true Greek restaurant in Greece could be any greens that they've gone and picked wild. It's typically one type each day, or they may have two different types of horta, but they're always kept separate. So somebody's collected horta, you can buy it at the market. It's foraged. Could be dandelion. It could be borage. It could be amaranth. And then there's some typical greens that you cannot find here that you just get in horta in Greece.
Now, so many of us who shop at the farmer's market have gotten used to this Italian way of cooking most of our greens by just, you know, throwing them in some hot oil with garlic and a pinch of red chili pepper. Is that the way you prepare horta?
No, horta is traditionally boiled in salt water. Salt water like you would cook pasta in. You would have a big pot of water and you want to kind of extract, because a lot of the greens are wild, they can be a little tough, and you also want to extract some of the bitterness.
So you really, really cook it. You're not just blanching it.
No, you're not. You want to cook it till tender, but still nice and bright green.
And then before you serve it, do you flash it in a pan or do you just drizzle the oil and lemon juice on it?
At home, you would cook this and serve it immediately with a little olive oil and lemon. You always want to have some of the cooking liquid with it as well. And then at the restaurant, what we do is we cook it and then we cool it and put it in the liquid that it was cooked in to hold it. And then it's reheated that way with a little olive oil and fresh lemon.
So you want it to be a little loose.
Loose and brothy. So it's always served in a bowl. The juice is very good. The older Greeks will drink it. They save their dandelion cooking liquid from their horta and make a tea.
Where do you get your ingredients? Olive oil and olives.
Yeah, olive oil, olives, feta cheese, and the oregano really set the flavors of the Greek cuisine. And if you don't have the best quality, you're not going to get there. It's just not going to be good. And so we're constantly sourcing new products, new importers, better qualities.
I think probably the best olive oil I've ever had in my life was a Greek oil I had in Greece. And it just seemed like they weren't so eager to export their best.
Yeah, this is true. Some of the best olive oil I've had is also from Greece, is from Crete mainly, produces some of the best olive oils.
Talk to me a little bit about oregano. So many people these days love to shop at the farmer's market and love to have an herb garden at home, and they're very happy when they use fresh oregano, but I just find that there's no substitute for really beautiful dried Greek oregano.
Yeah, there's two types of Greek oregano that we use at the restaurant. So I have one that's the standard cut Greek oregano, which is fairly mild. It's used for cooking. And then I have a wild mountain-grown oregano, which is used for the Greek salad and the saganaki, which you can't cook. It's so intense, though. And then the fresh oregano, you don't have that intense flavor, but it still fits into the Greek cuisine very well.
I want to ask you about skordalia. Could you describe what it is?
Skordalia is, it's all about garlic. There's two or three basic recipes for skordalia. One is almonds and garlic, another one's breadcrumbs and garlic, and another one is potatoes and garlic. It's basically almost half garlic pureed with olive oil and either breadcrumbs, almonds, or potatoes, or a combination of the two.
And how is it used?
Skordalia is great with anything fried, so it's very good with the fried favas, fried smelt. It's served often with a traditional combination is with beets or with fried bacalhaos or salt cod. It's very intense. It's kind of like a very strong aioli when it's done.
Well, thank you so much, Eric. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Eric Kosselman. He's the chef at Kokari in San Francisco. Find a recipe for his beets roasted Cretan style with skordalia on the Good Food blog. That sounds really good. Let's move away from garlic and oregano to embrace potatoes and cream. Jonathan Gold's here with me now, and he's taking us out for Irish fare. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times and our resident restaurant critic here at Good Food. Today, we're taking a new look at Irish bar food.
It's not St. Patrick's Day, but we're going to Tom Bergen's Tavern.
Oh, how fun!
It's that place on Fairfax that's actually one of the older restaurants in town. It's been there since the late 30s. And it's been taken over by, Brandon Boudet, who we've talked about on the show a lot, who runs Dominic's and Little Dom's. And in the way that he took over Dominic's and made the slightly disreputable Italian-American menu into a slightly disreputable Italian-American menu that was really thought about and tasted good. He's sort of done the thing with Irish-American bar food. As you know, the ceiling of the main bar room is encrusted with paper shamrocks with the names of regulars on them. And I would bet that a fair share of the shamrock holders still show up there. Superficially, the restaurant, looks and feels almost exactly the way that it did before it was redone.
So Brandon is sort of walking this fine line between informing the cuisine with what he knows to be Irish food.
Right.
But giving bar denizens something they would like to eat.
Right. So there's Colcannon on the menu, for example, which is everybody's favorite, you know, Monday night, this is what we do with leftovers meal. Colcannon is usually boiled kale, and it's mashed potatoes and with a handful of fried onions that are left over or not left over. And he redoes it as a salad. So it's a beautiful kale salad and sort of a light sort of, I think, creme fraiche dressing. It's on top of grilled potatoes that are sliced. They're still a little al dente. They have a nice smoky smell to it. You have the onions. And so you have out of what would be like a massive stodge, you have sort of a light, delicious supper.
So does he have something for somebody who wants to tuck into something piping hot and creamy and potato-y?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, there's cottage pie, and I've been instructed that it is not shepherd's pie.
No, because it's not made with lamb. It's made with beef.
Right. People are sticklers about this. So it's a nice beef stew, an Irish stew, as it were, in a crock topped with mashed potatoes. Broiled potatoes are crunchy, creamy. You have the stew underneath. It's a comforting dish on a cold night. And it probably should be mentioned that there's a substantial list of Irish whiskeys on the menu. Probably the largest in town, although Casey's also has a huge list of Irish whiskeys. But surprisingly, not a gigantic beer list. Which you wouldn't have. They have a perfectly poured Guinness with that, you know, head that's thick enough to probably float a paperback book on.
I love that about Guinness.
You'd be surprised how few people in town actually draw one correctly.
And I would imagine also it's not a place where you're likely to find a lot of pre-made Irish coffees anymore.
No, the Irish coffee is quite good. It's odd to talk about the desserts, but in a way, a couple of the desserts are close to perfect, which is the last thing you'd expect at a place like this. One of them is the chocolate silk pie, which is, as you know, usually too thick or has those clumpy cornstarch things. And this is the texture of it is just ideal.
What is silk pie supposed to be?
Exactly. I think you should get that if you're not getting the bread pudding.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about Tom Bergen's on Fairfax between Wilshire and San Vicente. Get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes by simply texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And you can also see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant Map, which is on our blog, The Good Food Blog. If you missed any part of today's show, we have it all for you in so many different places. You can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Good Food is produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laurel Garcia is our segment producer, and our executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson, Gary Messiha, and Sarah Rogozin. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.